Something is wrong. Something doesn't feel natural. When the entity set out to rewrite history, during the Age of Transition, controlling and changing the printed word would not be enough. It's one thing to rewrite narrative, but in doing so, the physical world needs to change in line with it. The medieval temples of India. Ruined, decimated, and then restored in the 19th century. Who restored them? The west facade of Lichfield Cathedral, mid-restoration. Today a multitude of cast statues reside in these niches. They tell Britain's history. Were there other statues present here before restoration? Did they tell a different story? The cathedrals, the ships of Theseus, the multitude of changes, making it almost impossible to understand the structure's original language. But the architectural changes are just one kind. There is a lot more to this story of revision and erasure. And before we turn to architecture, we must chase a different rabbit. And it's worth knowing that this burrow goes so deep, it unsettles. Something is wrong, and it's tremendously worrying. In our current digital age, we are bombarded by the constant haze and hum of blue artificial light and unclean electromagnetic frequencies. During our free time, it's good to get away from it all. If you live in a country like England, you are almost spoilt for choice. Vast and sprawling parklands belonging to the country's heritage estates are found in abundance, in their hundreds. Chatsworth, Blenheim, Trentham, Shugborough, Clumber, Woolerton, Weston. It's the weekend and it's good to get away from it all. Out into the parks, a breath of fresh air, a spot of exercise strolling around their vast lakes, a picnic on the grass, back in nature, rejuvenating, reconnecting. But something is wrong. Something doesn't feel natural. And that's because it isn't. For you see, the majority of England's enormous, sprawling country estate gardens and landscapes are not what they seem. They are artificial. Meet Lancelot Brown, otherwise known as Capability Brown. During the 1700s, Brown was responsible for redesigning over 170 of the finest country homes and parklands in the United Kingdom, many of which survive today. Brown's signature style was so influential that a wealth of other landscape designers adopted his vision and continue to redesign hundreds more. Capability Brown has become a household name. His landscaping design changed the country so much that he is now referred to as the Shakespeare of gardens. He was a leading frontman for the entity, setting in motion a fashion that would obliterate England's medieval heritage. Beware of fashions. They are often catalysts for control. And from the 1400s to the 1800s, the classical style of architecture was all the rage. Sneaky classical. It wasn't enough just to be popular, was it? You had to smear your rival. The insipid taste of Gothic ornamentation, these odious monstrosities of an ignorant age, produced by the torrents of barbarism. You see, to encourage society to warm to and embrace a revived classical style, and to use it to replace their medieval heritage, propaganda like this was necessary. Means of disseminating propaganda were limited in the 1700s, but one of the key ways this was achieved was through literature. Literature was the equivalent of our television shows, and it was English poet Alexander Pope who helped ensure that the elite and wealthy wanted to spend their money destroying the majority of medieval estates in the UK and renewing them in the classical style. Pope promoted the idea of following ancient or classical principles in the garden as well as in architecture. In 1711, in his essay on criticism, he wrote, "Learn hence for ancient rules just esteem. To copy nature is to copy them." What does that mean? To copy nature is to copy them. Prior to Capability Brown, The large manorial estates found across Britain were designed and adhered to a formal geometry. The gardens follow precise geometric formations, straight-lined avenues, canals, walled spaces, and tiered terraces, much like we see here at Powis Castle. Much like we see here in this plan. It was all about geometry, and they had to go. As one of the propagandists wrote at the time, "The natural garden will make his design submit to nature, and not nature to his design." Capability Brown and his contemporaries removed avenues, parterres, terraces, basins and canals, everything partaking of the old art and geometry from the environs of great houses. In their place, they laid out what we now describe as landscape parks, informal and natural in character, eschewing straight lines and formal geometry. This was Chatsworth House in the 1600s. This is it today. Brownian landscapes can be characterized by the following. They consist of vast, uninterrupted stretches of land, merging the garden with the landscape beyond, punctuated by irregular clumps of woodland and trees. Thousands upon thousands of trees were moved and planted for this effect. An immense amount of earth was moved to smooth the landscape, to create hills, to cover the medieval landscape that existed before it. Straight lines were everywhere replaced by curves and sinuosity. To not obstruct the view of the greater landscape from the house, formal walls were removed and inverted. This is a ha-ha. It is an inverted wall, or sunken wall. From the perspective of the house, it gives a continuous, uninterrupted view. And from the outside of the house, it prevents any livestock from entering this area. Finally was the redesign of the landscape's water networks. Their previous geometric formations were replaced with irregular bodies of water. Artificial lakes and serpentine rivers were created instead, curving through the greater landscape like a snake. These characteristics define the Brownian landscape, and his style was immensely influential and was widely copied, so that many hundreds of landscape parks had appeared in England by the time of his death, and still exist today. As this map shows, Brown sites alone covered almost the entirety of the country. You see this landscape, from the clusters of trees, to the smooth gradients of hills, to the woodland borders beyond, and the serpentine river and lake. It is all artificial. It was all man-made in the 1700s, and carefully constructed to look this way. And I know what you want to say. What? There is no way. But I'm not lying. Longleat and its gardens. In their analysis of Longleat's contracts, David Brown and Tom Williamson tell us that they describe how terraces were to be levelled, land drained, and walls removed, various basins and canals filled in or deformalized, and trees and shrubs planted, and gravel walks laid out. A ha-ha was to be constructed, and modifications made to the existing serpentine water so that its sharp turns were removed. Horace Walpole visited Chatsworth in 1761. His journal tells how they were widening and raising the river and carrying the park onto the side of it and levelling a great deal of ground to show the river. The estate accounts record regular payments to Michael Milliken, Brown's associate, for moving earth. The accounts for Harewood at the time reveal that workmen were engaged to remove a vast hill to the south of the house, and this project went on for 10 years, using 10 to 45 labourers. This is the south view of Harewood. It's man-made. All Brown's landscapes are artificial. For all their supposedly natural appearance, Williamson writes, Brown's lakes were alien impositions on the landscape, often being highly engineered. The process of creating these features was often the largest and most technically demanding of any earthwork operation. A significant body of water would need to be penned, and the level maintained through the year. In some sites, Brown reshaped extensive topography and diverted rivers to create the shape of the water feature. Manipulation of the water was achieved through a variety of means. The most simple method was erecting a dam across a watercourse so that water was ponded back behind it. They would build an earthen embankment dam, dig out sections, and shape the edges of the lake to create an ideal form. Some dams were large, up to 210 meters long. Where the geology for creating lakes was impermeable, a measure of puddling with clay was sometimes required to ensure that the lake held water. This method of rammed clay or puddling creates a watertight material that offsets water permeability and was used in the construction of canals. When there was no natural watercourse available, where rivers were absent, artificial ones would be created by the use of valleys and damming of streams. If such natural resources were lacking, then artificial lakes could be constructed instead. Brown would engineer these artificial lakes to be fed from a number of small streams and springs. Several sites contained a pre-existing water body, typically a canal or fish pond, which Brown expanded and reshaped into long lakes. Often a complex and extensive system of channels and culverts would be created to mitigate any risk of flooding. Brown created drainage systems, parallel sets of underground brick-built barrel drains, to ensure land would not become waterlogged. Damp, moory ground, despite its location in the park, was removed. A certain mindset developed. If it could not be so improved, it should be drowned, if possible, beneath the waters of a lake. I hope you understand the enormity of Brown's activities, the vast amount of earth moving required to achieve this vision. Capability Brown, the Shakespeare of gardens, the great earth mover. It is almost unfathomable, and it characterized a majority of engineering construction throughout the 1700s. Did you know that for outside of a few limited areas, few water bodies of any size actually existed in lowland England at the start of Brown's career? Now there are huge lakes thanks to Brown. He remodeled the entire landscape of lowland England. Something is wrong. Something doesn't feel natural. The great earth mover. And what is earth? Soil. Mud. But how on earth was this the product of one man? How was Brown so capable that he reshaped England like this, especially during the 1700s? The lone entrepreneur and genius visionary is a story, a narrative. This was not the product of one man. That's the lie, the cover story. This was nothing less than a nationwide operation, carried out by hundreds, if not thousands of individuals. Operation Capability Brown. Operation Earth Mover. And before we look at who the Earth Movers were, it is necessary to highlight what the purpose of this operation was. Two objectives, the first of which would cause, as scholar Jonathan Finch has noted, the final obliteration of the earlier medieval manorial complex and its landscape. As Williamson also confirms for us, Brown's landscapes erased all signs of earlier history, as well as all aspects of local character. In some sense, they were earth sculptures. They have caused an archaeological lacuna, devoid of earthwork traces of the pre-park landscape. A lacuna is an empty space, an absence, a missing part. Some remains of the previous medieval landscape are traceable, but most of it has been muted or obliterated. And not only have ecologists, geologists, landscape experts studied Brown's landscapes and confirmed their artificialness, but recent excavations at Harewood House revealed part of the manorial complex, and, critically, the earth moving enacted by Brown and his men to erase the site from view. Very little worked stone was recovered from the site, indicating it was reused elsewhere on the estate. And the voids which have been left within the building were first filled with large pieces of rubble from the demolished building. The whole site was then covered with a demolition layer of rubble pieces, broken bricks, and a considerable amount of plaster or lime, within which was mixed discarded ceramic and glassware. The demolition layer was spread across the site. Obliterated, erased, our medieval history, now a lacuna. Andrew Wilde informs us that Brown compromised very little, sometimes destroying ancient avenues of fine trees, magnificent old yew hedges, and even historic mansions. In their place, Brown created scenes of sweeping turf, often covering hundreds of acres. Destroyed. Buried. And listen to this. Sometimes the radical nature of Brown's work drew criticism, as in the case of Rosh Abbey, where he grassed over the outline of the abbey ruins, leaving only the upright fragments rising from a bowling green lawn. It wasn't enough to remodel pretty much the entire English landscape. They were burying the monasteries that were already in ruin, destroyed two centuries before. Williamson really hits home the message of just how enormous and unfathomable this level of historical erasure was when he states, "What is so striking about such endeavours is that until we are told that this great effort has been made, we would often not know it." The second objective of Operation Capability Brown was, in some ways, even darker. To create these vast landscape parks in the 1700s, Parliament passed Enclosure Acts. This meant that suddenly, the land surrounding these sites no longer belonged to the common people. Their rights of access were removed, and fields were enclosed by hedges, walls, or fences. In other words, it enabled the portion of land belonging to the elites to expand and absorb everything around it. The enclosure bills amounted to 6,800,000 acres, or one-fifth of the total area of England. This caused a widespread displacement of people. It affected small-time farmers, villages, and eradicated a whole history of localized culture. Wilde informs us that the enclosure involved the removal of communal rights, controls, or ownership over a piece of land, and enabled the total control of a vast acreage, which could be used for grand designs. This gave Brown and others power to change entire villages. For instance, at Milton Abbas, where he was involved with the clearance and rebuilding of the village. In some cases, many were destroyed. A substantial hamlet of Bowood in Wiltshire was removed when the park was laid out and partly drowned beneath the lake. Not only did it allow the powers that be to erase historical sites, but also stifled any chance of the lower classes maintaining localized prosperity. The world was changing. The Industrial Revolution was happening. Workforce was needed elsewhere in different industries. It changed so many people's lives and displaced their heritage. And it's still unfathomable and hard to conceptualize just how much of England's history and landscape they managed to change during one century. And I cannot emphasize it enough as to just how big a single one of these artificial landscape parks are. As a frontman, Capability Brown gets all the credit, but he was just one landscaping leader operating within this larger Operation Earth Mover. And a closer look at the historical literature and his records tell us everything we need to know. Contemporary correspondence makes it clear that Brown usually made no more than 4 visits each year to a particular site, often fewer. It was, rather, Brown's very capable associates who were responsible for much of what was created in his name. Brown's records show that by 1768, his profits had risen to £32,279, equivalent to many millions of pounds today, and that among his clients were half of the House of Lords. But they also show that there were many subcontractors, utilised to carry out his designs, highly skilled individuals that often supplied their own labour force. Subcontracting gave Brown the flexibility to respond to demand across the country. It enabled him to create a national landscaping business and rapid expansion. But as Williamson notes, Brown's books throw up a host of other names about whom relatively little is known. Many were apparently gardeners or nurserymen who were recruited locally, but who often then remained for many years in Brown's service. These were Brown's army of four men, who he relied on to implement his plans to a high standard without close supervision. Men were recruited from varied backgrounds by these four men. Sometimes a state labor was used to implement some or all of a design. Sometimes local labor was directly recruited. There were cohorts of surveyors and draftsmen ready to service the expanding market. The four men often went on to become successful themselves, as was the case with Thomas White. He and his son went on to landscape more than 200 estates in Yorkshire and Scotland. Brown's four men were trusted to such a high degree that when they encountered issues and had to change plan, they did so without Brown's approval. One account reports having to make a body of water 90 feet wider than Brown's original plan, of which the foreman concluded, "I think it will look well." As Finch writes, this is important evidence because it clearly shows that Brown's foreman was confident and trusted enough to take the initiative and had the ability to achieve Brown's overall vision, even when it meant adapting his plans. It also shows that the foremen were confident taking risks and not consulting Brown, even though they were working on estates that belonged to the country's most elite. Whoever these foremen or subcontractors were, they were trusted, knew exactly what they were doing, and were able to employ workforces readily. The whole thing reads like a tightly controlled inside job. Absences abound, in which the details are kept under lock and key. Even researchers acknowledge that there remain questions about how projects were approached, organized, and directed. And it appears that a strategy of following the money is not going to provide us with the required understanding, as there are too many missing links. But when we dig more and look a little closer, we find a curious clue. In his analysis of Brown's remodeling of Harewood House and its landscape, Finch informs us that a year before Brown's first visit, a John Wooler of Whitby visited, producing a detailed design. Who was John Wooler? Well, originally a military engineer who had worked on several projects in the northeast. Gotcha. If there was a significant and burgeoning landscaping industry, most of which was headed up by Brown, what is a former military engineer doing visiting sites and producing plans? Interestingly, when discussing the burial of the former medieval site at Harewood, Finch notes that the depth at which it was buried was considerably less than recommended by contemporaries and may reflect the urgency of the operation. Is that why a military engineer paid a visit? Was there an urgency to erase this site? It raises questions. Was the military involved at other sites? Was there a force above Brown orchestrating and directing this operation? Was secret or tacit military engineering technology used in re-landscaping the entire nation? A 1773 Act of Parliament suggests that something secret was certainly occurring. Parliament established a mechanism of road closure orders, creating perimeter belts around these sites, and which served to provide a measure of seclusion and privacy, as did the lodges which were erected at the gates of the larger parks. Parks removed the homes of local people and the fields of their labour from the polite gaze. Contracts drawn up when parks were created are sometimes quite explicit in this. They diverted and closed footpaths and roads. They wanted to be hidden. Was this to hide secret military involvement? Or perhaps to hide the act of heritage destruction? Perhaps they buried a lot more than we know at these sites while re-landscaping. And if you're having doubts about whether this wide-scale re-landscaping of England was indeed an operation, then consider this. These parks look like this today, but at the time they would have looked very different. Not only would each job take decades, but for a long time the earth would have been without grass. Most of the trees would have been very small. As Lady Shelburne wrote at the time, Brown's plantations were very young, but promising. It's generally accepted that many illustrations of the time imagined how the sites would look in the future. 18th century landscape gardens can now be experienced at a level of maturity that was never possible when they were first landscaped and planted. As trees have grown and matured, these gardens have taken on an appearance that their creators could only have imagined. What would it take to live on a construction site for most of your life, and to pay the landscaper significant sums of money to do so? Did Parliament bribe the elite with the Enclosure Act, allowing them to own more farmland, and with the promise of a big return in the agriculture business in exchange for years of re-landscaping? If so, who was directing Parliament to do this? And why is Operation Capability Brown important? 1. It provides us with direct evidence that a tremendous portion of England's landscape is not natural, but was artificially created during the 18th century. Geologists, ecologists, landscape researchers, and archaeological evidence of cement layering all confirm this. 2. It provides us with evidence that there was an agenda to erase England's medieval history. It was destroyed and buried. Its water systems were reconfigured, and the architecture was replaced in the classical Roman style. It also provides us with another instance of military involvement in construction. And 3. Brown's landscapes provide us with hard evidence of earth moving and earth sculpture on an enormous and unfathomable scale. And it's this final point that has greater and more worrying implications. Something is wrong. Something doesn't feel natural. For years and years, archaeologists have dug through the earth, clearing the mud, on the hunt for the remains of previous civilizations, on a quest to uncover traces of history. Was centuries of soil accumulation always an accepted theory? In our present era of contradictory truths, the curious challenge this assumption. What if it isn't soil accumulation, but the results of a cataclysm? Perhaps a mud flood? What unsettled you more, viewer? A cataclysm, or a deliberate, wide-scale and almost unfathomable burial at the hands of man itself? Don't you find it curious that many archaeological discoveries occurred during the 19th century and after? What if the landscape at some of these sites was deliberately engineered this way? Deliberately sculpted? Deliberately buried? What if they aren't as old as we think they are? If you came to England and walked these parks, would you know they were artificial? Were these parks designed like this to stop archaeologists digging in these locations? Has an operation like this occurred elsewhere and in an undisclosed manner? It's very interesting that the ground seems raised in many specific locations around the world. But this is not the same, and compared to Brown's landscapes, it seems child's play. Something is wrong, and it's tremendously worrying. The Earth Movers. Our buried history. I'd like to show you something that might surprise you. This new classical style of architecture is a later rendition of the Palladian form. It is one of the most prevalent styles found throughout the Brown Parklands. A classical estate, summoning the spirit of Rome. They replaced the medieval sites that once existed in these very locations. But look closer. Really look. Can you see it? A hidden message, encoded into the architecture itself, that perhaps only those in the know can truly understand. The bottom layer of this later Palladian style often features rustication masonry. Like Brown's Gardens themselves, rustication masonry creates the illusion of authenticity. The blocks are supposed to look rustic, antique, old, but they have been purposefully crafted this way. A symbolic and coded message in the architecture itself. The rustication here symbolizes the old, the former, the past. A hidden in plain sight, mocking gesture to its medieval predecessor. We built ourselves on top of you, on top of the old. We now own the land, and you exist beneath us. And we will continue to dominate and squash you into the very ground below until you are no longer visible and belong to ancient history. They are telling us, we know what's beneath because we buried it. And is that a stretch? Looking for coded messages in all styles of architecture.
Because they're often packed with religious codes and messages. So the first thing you notice from this entrance porch is that it's got five sides to the bay. One, two, three, four, five. And each side is 5 foot long. Three, four, five. Five times five, 25. That symbolizes the 25th of December, Christ's birthday, and the 25th of March, the date of the Annunciation to the Virgin Mary.
Huh, perhaps it's not a stretch after all. And it really seems that the classical is full of symbolism and hidden messages. Blenheim, one of Capability Brown's finest landscapes. But look at the palace's ceiling. The all-seeing eye. The eye of the entity. I think it's time we took a closer look at this classical style and how it rose again